In 1979, a football match was played at the Hawthorns, home of West Bromwich Albion. On one side, 11 white players. On the other, 11 black players. Whites versus blacks. Yes, really. Stranger still, back then it all felt rather progressive. Now the very thought of it makes you wince.
You didn't realise that we were actually making history at that time, on that day.
From the journey of coming over here, not seeing black players, and then we can put out a team.
Everybody's of one mind, we're going to beat them.
We're going to beat them.
So what does this tell us about how things were then for black people?
We don't want these people in our society. We will not abide by the Race Relations Act. Being all true white British people.
I was a traitor. I was a white whore, and he was being ruled by the white girl.
When I was on the pitch, I heard everything.
Well, he was calling you a coon. Off back to your country.
You would watch amazing football. Music, oh, if only they were white.
And here's Regis. And what can we learn about how far we've come today?
To see Cyril and then Laurie Cunningham and Brendan Batson, see them get through, you know that it can be done.
Speak into as many of these documentaries as you like. You ain't changing what's in people's heads right now.
Whites versus Blacks, how football changed a nation. Hashtag Black and British. Grey skies above a football ground, a statue of a footballer, then a fluttering West Bromwich Albion flag. Adrian Childs arriving with other fans for a match.
My football team's been a massive part of my life for nearly all my life.
Match days at West Brom takes me right back to being a little kid. My granddad used to drive me up here about 3 hours before kick-off. Give me a bag of chips and curry sauce and just leave me in the car for 3 hours while he went for a pint with his mates. And I'd just sit there eating the chips, doing my homework, watching the crowd gather, just getting into a frenzy of excitement. And about 10 to 3, he'd take me into the ground.
For as long as I can remember, my clubs put me through the mill week in, week out, year in, year out. My obsession took root very deeply back in the 70s.
I mean, it's sort of a hall of fame. To me, it almost feels like a family album. Look at that for a strike. Look at that. Tony Brown, he feels like my Uncle Tony. There's John Wyle. I wish he was my uncle too, heroic figure. It just kind of feels like family. I can't express it any other way. Ali Robb, ferocious, getting in some crunching tackles. Crunching being a euphemism for fouls. And Cyril, look at those biceps there. There's Brenda, look at that body shape. Look at the afro. Look at the focus, look at the sweat on his legs, he's beautiful. And there's the late, great Laurie Cunningham.
A black player.
That we had so many black players gave the whole experience something extra. It made us feel different, special. I recall matches where we scaled footballing heights. And matches where my black heroes were subjected to the vilest abuse.
Adrian celebrating with other fans in a packed stand.
But there's one match that intrigues me more than any other, that if played today, would surely cause an outcry. 1979, a testimonial for Len Cantello, to reward him for his long service to the club. As for exactly whose idea it was to play blacks against whites, no one at the club can remember. Nobody wants the credit or, possibly, the blame. The first expert witness for my investigation is a man who was there and saw it all through his viewfinder. Laurie Rampling, unofficial club photographer for as long as anyone can remember.
This is going to be like an Aladdin's cave for me.
All right, this way, Adrian.
My word, look at this.
This is the first Atlantic room. This is where I do all my work.
I love that picture.
Yep, that's one of my favourites.
This must be the most extensive collection of Albion stuff
in all the United Kingdom.
If not the world.
It's the Europe.
Is there anything you haven't got? It needs a sign on it, the Rampling Albion.
The Rampling Albion Den.
So what about pictures of that actual game?
Yes.
Have you got any
pictures here? Yeah, this is from my archive of the game.
What do you remember about it? You remember the idea being hatched?
I do, I remember it. And I thought, what a fantastic idea. And straight away, when you knew what the occasion was about, you knew that you had to get a picture of the team group because it
probably never ever happened again, and it hasn't.
What did you think? Do you remember what you thought when you looked through that, through the viewfinder and just saw all those black players? The first time you ever saw that happen?
Yeah, wow. It was a photograph that had a wow factor, and I thought that's going to be one of the most iconic pictures in football.
The stadium on the day of the match.
In that era, in the National Front still active, there was a lot of people who basically wanted to fight white versus black. Yeah. But obviously a testimonial game, you know, it's a fun game. But was there any kind of racial charge to it?
Well, if there was, I certainly didn't feel that, because by this time you'd got Brendan Batson, Cyril Regis and Laurie Cunning. Albion heroes, if you like, you know.
So there's a piece in The Guardian from 1979. Says the local community relations council said it can only be an innocent mistake. He said, I hope the club will have second thoughts. A match of this kind could easily be used by certain sections of the community to make political capital, and there could well be trouble in the crowd.
There were eyebrows raised by certain people whether it was a good idea. And I remember I said at the time, well, why? And even today I say, well, why? You know, why was it a bad idea?
And that's the question. Why, arguably, wasn't it a bad idea then? And why, in retrospect, does it feel so plain wrong now? By 1979, Britain had been through a right old turbulent decade. For a generation, the West Midlands, where I grew up and the Albion ply their trade, had been something of a cauldron of racial tension. In the white community, there was fear, bewilderment and ignorance in equal measure, something our new Prime Minister soon had a handle on.
People are really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture.
Violent clashes during a protest march.
Well, why should they have our jobs? You know, if we start beating them up and that, I might get the message clear off.
With the milk of human kindness running this sour, was a whites versus blacks football match really the wisest move?
Adrian walking along a suburban street.
To get a sense of how the players felt about it, I've arranged to meet three members of the white team that day. John Wyle, our club captain.
That's the goal, and it's gone to Wyle.
Prolific goal-scoring midfielder, Tony Bomber Brown.
Yes, that'll do it.
And our frankly terrifying defender, Ali Robertson.
And the free kick against Alistair Robertson, which he got the worst of.
And I've got three of my heroes here. I want you to know, you're still my heroes, even now. That has not, my love hasn't waned with time. So you all lived round here, didn't you? Like one big happy family.
Absolutely.
Brendan lived here.
Yeah.
I lived up there. You lived over there.
That's right.
But we all met in there.
I want to buy you three a drink.
That sounds all right to me.
Let's do it. You're still in good shape, you three. You're moving very well. I think you've got a new hip or two, haven't you? But you're moving well to
three.
Make time.
Well,
three.
A football shirt and small trophy top the contents of a cardboard box.
Let me just get this. Is this yours, Ali?
Yes, I found that in my dad's loft.
Well, just, you know, when I see this, you know, I cry. There's a semi-final, Highbury. Yeah, that's when you cut your head against Ipswich.
John Wyle being treated for West Brom. Fairly a horrific sight being cleaned up.
Have you still got the scar from that?
Believe it or not, it was very, very small.
Was it?
It was just in the wrong place.
Well, that hasn't been stitched, but in a fight, it would have been stopped.
We come to Len Cantello's testimonial, the black versus white match. Now, I remember thinking at the time, and I was, you know, I was 12 or something, I was like a liberal kind of white middle-class boy, I think, oh, that's really sweet. It felt progressive to me. What are your memories of it?
I can't remember that much about it. The only thing I can remember is there was more coloured people or black people in the crowd.
The game itself doesn't sort of stick in my memory as something. I think that year I played something like 76 games.
Tony Brown.
It was just another game to us. I think it was just a way of to get more of a crowd, something different, yeah, an interest, because there was quite a few testimonials and people get fed up with testimonials.
Well, this was certainly different. There hadn't been many black versus white matches.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So the idea was fantastic.
I came from a small mining village and you never saw a black person up in that area. And when I moved down here and my family came down to visit, they always used to remark on the fact that there's a lot of black people down here.
I'd never seen a black person. I come down to West Brom and I was in Diggs in Handsworth. And I always remember picking my mum up and we brought her down Soho Road and she couldn't believe all these Afro-Caribbeans. She couldn't believe how many black people there were.
And no one could quite believe how many black players we had. Three of them, when the number of them in all British football barely ran into double figures. The media loved them, and the manager, Ron Atkinson, knew how to work the media. He dubbed them the Three Degrees, a nickname which stuck fast.
When those lads come, they were no different to anybody else. Because we saw them dress in the dressing room, you dressed with them, you bathed with them.
You saw them undressed in a way. I mean, well, you never had a black friend, never seen a black man, suddenly you're in a bath with a black man. I mean,
you joke. The little things were said, but it was part of the dressing room banter. And dressing rooms are completely different from anywhere else, Adrian, you know what I mean? These players shrugged it off and laughed it off and just got on with it, you know what I mean? That's the way it was.
With the banter, you're learning about the language, you're learning about each other. Sometimes, was the line ever crossed? You must have seen him angry or upset. Somebody might have said something which is a bit too much.
Outside the group, yes. And I've seen it outside the group, but we'd be the first ones to stand in and say, go away. In our lads, I don't think I've heard one person say a bad word.
Looking back now, do you think you feel any different about their experience? Do you ever find yourself thinking, blimey, it must have been harder for them than we thought, actually, at the time.
I do, yeah, definitely, it must have been. We didn't realise at the time, because it was all this football banter and that, but you don't know how they felt inside themselves, you know.
It's fascinating. They remember lots of it very well, that era, but they don't remember really anything about that black versus white match. Oh, that's the white players. I'd be very surprised if the black players involved, every single one of them, didn't remember every detail of it.
As these black players gathered for that match, did they have any misgivings about playing in it? Did it feel right, wrong, odd, or just a bit of harmless fun? Cyril and Brendan meet me in what feels like a different world altogether. Their memories of the match and the whole era are as fresh as you like.
You know, I was watching you, and you in the 70s, you were living through that brutal time. I mean, how could you get across the brutality of it?
Well, first 2-3 years as a professional footballer, I tell stories that you go to Millwall, Chelsea, Tottenham, you're getting 10,000 people singing, "Nigger, nigger, lick my boots." I mean, 10,000 people. I mean, having three black players in a side was late 70s, it was radical.
In those days, we went across to West Ham, just a hail of bananas was coming towards us. I remember throwing it at Cyril. I think he put it down your shorts and I peeled one and that, you know. But I look back on it and I'm thinking, what else could I have done?
What can you do?
Could you show hurt?
No, made you angry, but we learned to channel the anger and motivation. Go, right, we're going to show you how good we are.
Has he got the poise? He has!
The hurtful part is that my wife wouldn't come. She came a couple of times and she just said she wouldn't come again. She went and she said, I'm not going to go again, Bren, because it's just disgusting. It's just disgusting, you know? It's the volume that suddenly is a shock.
The feeling of the black players repaid by Tony Brown.
My kids look at me and they go, blimey, Dad, we can't understand how you've managed to come through that. Mm. But that was our life and that's what we had to deal with. And, you know, either you're determined and you want to make your way or you're not, and then you fade into the background and you do something that you don't really want to do.
It's survival of the strongest.
What comes to me is you've got to overcome.
Yeah.
You're an overcomer. You have these barriers, you have these... Either you give up and go, I can't take this no more, and you give up, or you say, you know what, despite these barriers, despite the race, and despite this, I'm going to overcome this by my ability and my sheer will and desire to be a professional footballer. And that's what we've done.
So when the idea of this game was floated, a black versus white game, I mean, it's, without hindsight, what was in your mind then? You just think, why not? Or
we all thought, great idea, great idea. But it was just a novelty, and we never once thought about any other social aspect of it. We didn't hear any dissenting voices. There was never anybody rang us up and said, do you realise the implication? Nothing at all. It was just a novelty thing.
Novelty, yeah.
And it was 100%. Fun. It was fun. Well, don't forget, we were always in the minority. From a kid, only black player, suddenly, this is a whole team of us. That's one of the attractions that we're actually playing in a team made up of all black players who, only a few years ago, there were hardly any of us.
Did the game matter? The outcome of the match matter to you?
Oh, big time. Because for us, it was just historic to get, you know, from the journey of coming over here, playing, getting told you're not good enough, not seeing black players, and then we can put out a team. It was great.
Everybody's of one mind, we're going to beat them.
We're going to beat them.
You know, some marmalades get some of their tang from added flavouring.
The further we move away from the 70s, when Cyril and Brendan were playing, the more culturally cruel it feels.
Never. They're quite jolly, really, aren't they? You don't have to have
a... What on earth were the black and white minstrels about? That's a plan for me. And love thy neighbour, for heaven's sake.
Equal rights does not entitle Nick Knocks to move next door.
A black man dressed like a tribal warrior.
Black people were invited to turn the other cheek and join in the laughter. Some found this harder to do than others. Up the road from the Albion are our arch-rivals Wolverhampton Wanderers. And in the centre of their defence and that of the black team of 79, George Berry and Bob Hazel.
Adrian meets them in a coffee shop.
So this picture here, what are your memories of that? What's your emotional response to seeing that?
It's fantastic.
Just bring back memories. Great memories.
And a great day.
It was a great occasion that everybody wanted to be a part of.
And we also wanted to win.
More so than the Albion
team. It's interesting, the white players involved are sort of very hazy about the whole thing, but the black players absolutely remember it completely. It was significant, wasn't it?
Actually, you didn't realise that we were actually making history at that time, on that day.
But, I mean, there was plenty of racial strife about, and there was some unease. It could kick off between black fans and white fans, you know, the National Front could get involved or something. Did you remember feeling that?
No, I think the black fans were still too shit scared to come to games during that time.
Yeah.
Because that's how it was, because, you know, with all the violence that took place. And I know many black people who wanted to come to games, but because of the way the violence was, they just wouldn't come.
A photo of Bob Hazel as a player.
When did you see the red mist over Monkey Chant, a banana being thrown, whatever horrors you had to go through? How did you deal with it? Did you ignore it? Could you hear it?
Do you know the funny... Yes. When I'm on the pitch, when I was on the pitch, I heard everything.
You heard every chant, and every racial chant you definitely heard. Sometimes, when I was getting the abuse, I felt isolated in so much as the opposition players would be giving me stick. But my teammates were laughing.
I was at Leicester City and the Leicester fans were racially abusing other black players. I cannot for the life of me see how they can racially abuse other players and it not affect me. And I remember the manager had a dig at me. Oh, Bob, they're just very small-minded people. Ignore them. I said, you ignore them, yeah? Because you can ignore them. But I says, me, I'm out there. I feel it. You can see I'm getting a little bit worked up now, can't you? But that's how I felt about it. I felt completely let down by them.
A keeper pumps the ball upfield.
We played against Watford in the Cup. Right at the end of the game, I went clear a ball, which was one of my trademarks, I actually scuffed it and it went to Luther Blissett, who smashed it in the top corner.
That's a dangerous one from Berry. Blissett, 3-0. Well, that was a pretty dreadful mistake. An unfortunate error by George Berry.
The game was finished and I was obviously very disappointed, walking off the pitch and we're out of the cup and everything. And as I was walking, this bloke, it was a fairly big geezer, he was giving me so much abuse.
What was he saying? Don't be afraid of using the words.
Well, he was calling you a black bastard and you fucking disgrace to the club and you fucking fuck off back to your country and you coon and all, everything, the whole lot, the whole, everything. Anything that could have been classed as racial, he said it. And I thought, actually, I ain't taking that. So I confronted him and I just told him, I said, what did you say? He says, you fucking... And I just jumped in the crowd and it's just give me a right hook. I was a bit of a boxer when I was a youngster, so...
So you both still seem quite bitter and angry.
I'm bitter and angry when we talk about the past racist things that we had to go through in what was the best time of my life.
It's very well put, that. So, 'cause these were the greatest times of your life and you weren't robbed of them, but they were solid.
Mm-hmm. Footage of a game from the period.
As tough as things were for the black footballers, at least they could show two fingers to the racists by socking it to them on the pitch. Up in the stands, their families, at least those who could bear to be there, were ploughing lonelier furrows. Bob and George's wives, Joy and Maureen, are still best of friends.
Well, I felt like a minority within a football club because I think the majority of the time I was the only black wife. And you'd scour the room just to hopefully see another black face. Inevitably, that never happened. So you'd really and truly rely on other wives or girlfriends to approach you because you'd want to feel accepted.
Mm. One option is just not to go to the matches. I mean, for that reason, and also, I'm sure, all the abuse that you heard.
I would want to go.
Yeah.
We'd have to support them.
That's supporting.
There's Berry. There's Richards. Beautiful goal. John Richards.
We chose to live in an area as well, near Alton Towers. I think we were the only black family in the village. So that was really difficult. And I think some of the acceptance came from the fact that George was a footballer. And I wonder what it would have been like for somebody who was just an ordinary working class person. And not George Berry, the footballer.
George is and was an uncompromising figure. Not for him any attempt to fit in, keep his head down and conform.
You say George Berry to anyone and you know the first thing you're going to hear is, and quite rightly, I mean, that hair arrangement is simply magnificent. It was one of the best in the world.
Yeah.
I wonder if the Jackson 5 were getting copies of Shoot or something, but they sort of, they'd be throwing, well, respect to George Berry.
And all his as well. No pretending. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He used to have his afro comb and it would be there. And it was my job to plait it every so often to make sure we could comb it through properly.
It's almost like dreadlocks. Interestingly, you didn't really see dreadlocks until you Rude Hullet about 15 years later.
What? Bob did want to lock his hair.
Did he?
But at that time, the FA would not allow it.
Well, did they construct some sort of health and safety argument?
I really don't know what it was, but I cannot put my finger on their exact reasonings for it. But because they were so old school, I think that if it was a case of making a statement about yourself and you wanted locks, it was too much for them to handle.
While the racist abuse hung heavy in the air, there were many random acts of kindness and solidarity. Bob went through a particularly unpleasant patch after a sending off with, it was said, racist undertones.
A lot of it came the one time when Bob was playing against Arsenal and things were said to him.
And there's some trouble. Tension's boiling up right at the end. And Hazel really has lost his cool and he's off.
I was able to keep some of the clippings. And the hate mail came because he was sent off, and as soon as he got sent off, the goal was scored and balls were out. It was an awful time.
Bob Arsenal winners by 2-1, right at the death.
You got this one. Oh, this is after...
This was after that game.
Snoopy-headed paper.
That's right.
Well, that's not going to be hate mail, is it? On Snoopy paper. Can you just read it to us?
Yeah. Dear Bob, I was a member of the North Bank at the Arsenal Cup tie. I would just like to tell you that not all of those at the match shared the opinions of the minority who were giving you stick. I am not coloured or foreign in any way. Take no notice of any crowds and answer their jeers with skill and with best wishes. And what was really beautiful about this letter is from a girl, and at the time she was age 14 and a half. I was really touched by it. For a kid who goes to a game, it might have been quite frightening for her, seeing such a thing happen. I don't know.
A photo of the black team.
Perhaps the most dazzling of all the black players among these pioneers was the son of a Jamaican jockey, Laurie Cunningham. Our third degree. He had the skill and speed to bewilder defenders and have us rubbing our eyes in disbelief up in the stands. He was the first British footballer of any colour to play for Real Madrid. He was killed in a car crash in Spain in 1989, aged just 33.
A railway arch workshop.
Laurie's career began at Leighton Orient, where a statue of him will soon grace that corner of East London. Today, his family are seeing it for the first time.
Hello, everyone. Sorry to intrude. I don't feel worthy to be sharing this moment with you, actually. I'm not part of the family, but it's 40 years ago. I was looking at him in the flesh as a, you know, my mouth wide open. None of us could believe what we were seeing. You know, I feel like crossing myself or something. Is it emotional when you first clap eyes on it?
Yeah. It looks real. It looks,
you know. It's captured the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Larger than life. Mm-hmm.
So there's pride, but there must be sadness as well.
Yes.
Of course.
He was so young, you know, to be taken like that so tragically. Mm.
But that was a great player. He was influential in a wider sense, wasn't he? A pioneering figure for so many black
everybody
players.
Wanted to play like him. Every footballer wanted to be him. They wanted to get his, some of his skills, but they can't, because you can't be trained to do that. He would do something, pick the ball up, and then that's it. Players standing there looking, how did he get there, you know? That was it.
And his personality was different to Brendan and Cyril's. He was quite a flamboyant dresser, wasn't he?
He had style. He had a lot of style. Mixed his clothes together, his colours together, you know, and that is how he was, man.
He stood out from the crowd, and you knew it was Laurie.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be quite emotional now. I mean, you lost him. He was so young. I was just...
It touched me, really. I mean... Yeah, it touched me, you know? Yeah. That's all I can say. I miss him very much, you know? Yeah. Miss him, man.
But we can't...
He just went suddenly, just like that. Left me the Monday and he did say anything. I've never seen my mum and dad crying. Mm. You know, touch us all. Losing him. Touch us all, man. Touch us all.
The whole world knew about Laurie's football skills, and his friends are adamant he was no less gifted with his dancing shoes on. As a teenager, as he was making waves at Orient, he was grooving with the best of them on London's dance floors. Laurie met his first proper girlfriend, Nikki Brown, in 1974. Not the easiest time to embark on a mixed-race relationship.
So when did you first clap eyes on my hero?
The Tottenham Royal Soul Funk Night. And that was my love. And I was dancing, and then some of the moves he was doing, and somehow we migrated, and as crowds did then, they gathered round. So we kind of did a bit of a dance-off where he'd do a move and I'd do a move, and you have a dance-off in a friendly way with each other. And then a Marvin Gaye tune come on and we had a slow dance, and seven tunes later we were still dancing. And it was just right.
Seeing through your eyes, what was the experience like of being a black player at the time? I think these were hard times, the 70s. It was a tough period. Mm.
It was hard anyway, walking down the road as a mixed-race couple. I was a traitor. I was a nigger lover or a white whore, and he was a traitor, being ruled by the white girl. He was only after his money. So it came from both sides.
So how did you deal with it?
Depended on the circumstances. I did a quick risk assessment and depended on the circumstances. I loved him, so I didn't want anything to hurt him.
But then sometimes a line would be drawn.
Yeah. We went to our favourite takeaway in Birmingham along the Hagley Road, and we just got our takeaway and three big blokes came down the road. And as we walked past, one spat towards me and said, "Oh, nigger love a white whore." And I said to Laurie, "Leave it." And he looked, turned and looked, and he said, "I can't leave it." And so I turned around and they'd already stopped and were turning and coming back anyway. One of them went to headbutt him. It happened so quick. But Laurie, being like he was, ducked one side and cuffed the back of his head, and the man's own force threw himself on the ground. And then he threw the other one on top of him, and the other one on top of him, Laurie did. And where one of them had fallen, his nose was bleeding. And then he was the one that turned round and said, "It's Laurie Cunningham.
Yeah.
And I love you." And he goes, "Sorry, Laurie." And Laurie's going, "Look at your nose."
And then what? All shake hands, "Lovely to meet you," and off you go. I just don't get it.
And that's what I'm saying to you. You never really get it. You just, because then when we did jump in the cab and go home, you can't really say, you don't say anything. There's nothing you can say because you can't work it out.
You can't compute it.
So you do things like, and I went, "Oh no, you've got his blood on your shirt." So we discussed what would be the best thing to get it out. And then it's only later on that night, a few hours later, when you've processed it, and it's like, whoa.
What fascinates me, there's some guy in his 60s, somewhere in Birmingham now. Does he tell a story in a pub? "You know, this one time, this black bloke, I was going to beat him up, and then I was on the floor." Do you know who it was? Laurie Cunningham?
No,
he was ever so nice.
I mean, I wonder if he's dined out on it. Yeah, I do, and he probably has. But maybe that has led to him evolving. Or maybe he hasn't, and he just tells it as a funny story and doesn't realise what a racist he sounds. You'll never know, will you? You'll never know.
This casual racism, for all its evil banality, was only half the problem. Darker, more organised forces were at work too.
"We've created a powerful movement out of nothing. No power on earth is now going to stop this movement. We'll carry on marching like a great army towards the Britain of our dreams."
A National Front rally and march.
"The word nigger means a person of a black face, and I will always call that person of a black face a nigger."
The far right were about more than mere rabble-rousing. The National Front waded into football fans as part of a deceptively sophisticated recruitment campaign.
"We will recruit patriotic, pro-British youngsters because we need everybody in the National Front. I think there's a lot you can do with a soccer hooligan, and we feel that the very, very fanatical adulation by supporters with their particular club is a sort of sublimated patriotism."
Adrian walking with a shaven-headed man past a football ground.
Nigel Bromage says he was targeted and groomed by the NF to be one of their foot soldiers. We meet outside his old battleground, St Andrews, home to Birmingham City.
So the atmosphere in there, what words would you use to describe it then?
You could feel the hatred. It was horrific. When you were coming in, there was NF lads who had gone down to Birmingham Market, and they would basically get a massive amount of bananas, and they would then be giving them out, or they'd be giving them out at the front of the cop, and then saying, "Hey, our lads, take these in with you."
Fans arriving for a match, escorted by police.
So how was it organised around the ground?
When we go in, people would be positioned around the ground, so you tend to have five at the back, split to have sort of two corners, or there'd be five in each corner there. And then you'd basically start a chant from the back, and then each of the different groups would start to involve. And then the whole idea, then the chant would get bigger and bigger as normal supporters got involved. And then the idea then, it would look like it's hundreds, if not thousands. And in reality, it was organised by a core of 40 or 50.
That's skillfully done, in a way.
Fighting in the stands.
The violence at that time could be anything from mass brawls on the terraces itself, And it wouldn't just be fists and boots. You know, I've witnessed Stanley knives used, and when somebody is standing next to you, and then they have then their face slashed with a razor blade, a Stanley knife, and that just splurts all over everybody.
I was probably here as well, but you must have seen my team here, Cyril, Brendan, Laurie, come and play.
Yeah, and you'd would watch amazing football. You'd look at it, and then a lot of the time you think, oh, if only they were white. And that's the actual feeling that you think, oh, if they were white, well, you know, they could be accepted then.
So you monkey chanted at my heroes then? How could you do that?
Yep, I'm afraid I did.
Nigel doth repent. He now runs an organisation devoted to teaching about the dangers of racism.
It's fascinating that it turns out there was kind of more to it than a load of football fans just being sort of casually racist. I mean, there was a lot of that happening. It was a disgrace and awful for the players and horrendous for the black fans in amongst them. But there was also far-right elements intent on actually organising it, positioning themselves around, doing the monkey chants, and then getting everybody involved. There were dark forces at work, really.
As determined and noisy and violent as the far right were, they were on the losing side in this war. By the time of the whites versus blacks match, relations between whites and blacks and Asians did seem to be changing for the better. And football, not least West Brom, was playing no small part in drawing them together.
Adrian walking with an Asian family.
The Deal siblings lived above their parents' paper shop, just near the Albion. It became a meeting point for fans of all colours.
So this is it, this is where the Deal commercial empire...
It was.
All changed, yeah. We used to have Samwell Evening Mail across there, I think Samwell. There'd be like newspaper boards here. Yeah. An Express and Star board there. The wall sign was there. It just all looks changed now.
It feels really small now, but then it was a really big shop, wasn't it?
It was kind of the hub of the community.
Inside what was their shop, the family take me back to 1970s Smethwick.
Find the one of you outside the shop in your West Brom kit, which that's my favourite. So
that's what the shop looked like.
Can you see that stand? That's 1977.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. As you can see that pose, that's John Travolta's pose on there.
Yes. Whatever.
Oh, wow. There's me and Dad outside the shop.
Most of the window was full with footballs.
It wasn't just us who wanted them, all the kids bought the footballs to mess about in the park, around the corner, or in the car park. Well,
before we get into cliches, it was tough here as an Asian family. I'm sure there were challenges, but you had a very happy time from day one, as I understand it, your family.
It was just fit in, buckle down.
Get on with it.
We've made this place our home and we are going to fit in. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter what background you came from around here, it was football, it was a religion, because it was what everyone talked about and everyone did.
It was the glue.
Yeah.
I bet you there weren't more than 10 Asian females in that crowd.
No, there wouldn't have been.
But it was
there
were not many Asian girls there, for definite. I don't remember seeing any others. That was the nice thing about Dad. If I wanted to go to the football, as long as he knew who I was with, where I was going...
And it was daytime.
He was quite brave, though, in that sense.
He'd say to me, go to a policeman if there's a problem.
Yeah.
Look out for the horses, because they'll be doing all the security. I want you back straight after the match.
Did it have particular resonance in you, seeing black men playing for West Brom when you're Asian?
Big time, because it was someone of colour.
Yeah.
So you kind of felt that was the change.
And you were the foreigners.
Yeah, look, someone of colour's there. Someone of colour is valued.
Someone else has come to this country and is doing really
well. It definitely gave you a bit of pride. Yeah. I remember that's where we used to play across the road football. And kids would want to be Kevin Keegan or Andy Gray or Bomber Brown. Suddenly they wanted to be Laurie Cunningham.
Even though they were still in a tiny minority, with the 3 degrees playing, black and Asian fans began to feel the Hawthorns was a safer place to be.
A coaching session.
Herville Hector was 19 years old in 1979. He's one of the very few black men who dared to go to games.
So the black versus white game, what did you think when you heard that was happening for Len's testimonial?
You thought,
blimey, you know, black team against the white team. Let's see how they're going to get on. And there's a massive buzz around the ground. The fans are all talking about it. And it was just great going to the game, wondering, well, let's hope they can beat them. Let's hope they can beat them to show that black players come more and more into the game.
So what made you a West Brom fan? I mean, you're in 25,000 white people. Were you ever frightened?
People going about how the black players got abused, bananas thrown at them, other stuff said to them. The same happened to us as supporters. And obviously, when we went to those games, we relied on the white guys that were with us to sort of protect us.
But did it feel wrong at all to have a black versus white match? Or did it feel like a nice thing to you?
It felt nice to me because all the things they said that were going on, the racism that was going on at the time, and you felt that there was nothing being done about it. For that to be at the forefront of the football, saying, well, hang on, maybe this is the start of change.
A goal.
Increasingly, black players were getting backing from the terraces. Where once they'd been abused, banners were now waved, celebrating their brilliance. The players in our Black 11 were all about proving they had the talent and just about the numbers to play in the white man's game. There were legends like Cyril and Brendan and Bob and George, Remy Moses, who went on to play for Manchester United, Garth Crooks too. Others weren't so well known. Stuart Phillips was at Hereford United. Ian Benjamin went on to play for Northampton Town. And there was a small, timid-looking left-back from the Albion's reserves I must confess I'd never come across until now.
Though I'm always fascinated about the views of the famous players and what they remember of that game, this guy has really captured my imagination now, the so-called fourth degree. His name's Vernon Hodgson. Just kind of a bit part player, basically a reserve player. Career didn't go anywhere. And I've heard that he's been a bin man all his life. 30 or more years since this game. So I'd absolutely love to track him down.
And I didn't have to go far to find him. Hard at work on the industrial estates around West Bromwich.
Vernon, is it you?
Yes.
It's Vernon.
Hello.
Did you play for the Albion by any chance?
Yes, I did, yes.
Amazing. The fourth degree, are you the man?
Yes, I'm the fourth degree.
And did you play in the black versus white Len Cantello testimonial?
Yeah. I come on for 20 minutes in that. Right. I had 20 minutes in that.
We head to Vernon's sister's hairdressing salon around the corner in Tipton.
So who spotted you? Where did your football career begin?
Birmingham City, chief scout for Birmingham City in 1974.
How old were you then?
About 14, 15. I was the first black professional at Birmingham City.
What was the atmosphere like in the dressing room when you had a black player for the first time and yourself? What was the reaction?
Well, it was almost like you get a minute's silence when you first walk in. And when I first started for the reserves, I remember the coach jumping up and down. I thought, what's happening? I remember him going, leave him alone, he's only bloody 16, give the lad a chance. And then I listened to what they were saying and they were shouting, we don't want a wog playing for us, blah, yeah. blah, blah. But by the end of that game, I had people coming up and shaking my hand. They liked me in the end.
Well, it's almost heartwarming, but it would be a nicer story if they weren't calling you a wog in the first place.
Vernon's from West Bromwich. Signed by Birmingham City, he was promisingly talented. But he did his knee in when he was 17, which at that time more or less meant your career was over. After a brief spell at Lincoln, Ron Atkinson gave him a trial at the Albion, right at the time of Len Cantello's testimonial.
So what do you remember of the black versus white game? You were playing alongside the superstars then.
Yeah. I thought, my God, it was groundbreaking. I can remember having a laugh with Cyril and all them. We was all joking about, like, when we run about passing the ball, we'll shout for the ball in Jamaica and, you know, right. Potter and all that. Really joked about that.
So I've got this this picture of you. Here you are. I just want to give you a hug for some reason. You look a bit lost and nervous, just sort of staring down here.
Gosh, I think I was worrying about my knee. A lot of times back then when I played in the reserves, it might sound sad now, but I'd have a drink at the night time to try and forget the niggle in my leg right. at the morning when I'm playing in the reserves. But it never went away. It just grinded and grinded, till in the end, I felt like I wanted my leg off from the knee down.
Really?
Seriously,
is that
yeah.
painful? So what on earth is it like to have tasted being a professional footballer and then your career knackered?
Nightmares for the rest of your life every so often. Well, wake up and think I've got training today.
Really?
Never goes from you. Never goes from you.
So you've had a life's work on the bins and you seem very happy with it.
Well, as soon as football was over, I turned into like a town drunk. I drank a lot, really lot. A lot of people would give me till I was 27 and I'd be dead.
So what got you out of that?
I'd say the bins. Yeah, changed my life. My job has, definitely.
Adrian's driving.
The black players of the 70s, legends and unknowns alike, were pioneers. They forced the door ajar for the likes of Ian Wright and Dion Dublin in the 90s, with Anger to Burn, to kick that door right down.
Ian Wright scoring, then Adrian showing Ian and Dion Dublin the photo of the black team.
And what's your response when you say that, 1979?
Unbelievable.
Hairstyles. Yeah. Afros.
You know, you're a teenager in the 70s. Mm. What did watching the 3 Degrees sort of mean to you?
Well, it was simply inspiring. And okay. Cyril Regis was the one because of the goal he scored that used to start matches with him, remember?
Yeah, just pinged it, didn't he?
Yeah, smashed it.
You heard him hit the ball, strike the ball.
Piece of control by Regis. Oh, and what a great shot! Oh, what a goal of the season! Cyril Regis.
Laurie Cunningham got his second with this header from a corner. 4-0.
Nothing with Laurie, man. This guy is one of the best I've ever seen in respects of left foot, right foot pace.
Still with Cunningham. Oh, he did so well there.
My team was West Brom, only because of the 3 Degrees. Mm. We're opening new doors for black players, black people, to try something new. If he can do it, I'm going to have a go.
From Cyril Regis.
To see Cyril and then Laurie Cunningham, Brendan Batson, see them get through, you know that it can be done. You know, it's hard, but you knew that there was people that were exception to the rule. If you're good enough, you can get there as hard as it is.
The players I've talked to from that era are different to you two. I mean, famously, you know, Cyril, there's a load of bananas on the pitch. Cyril picked one up and ate one. Mm. Now, in a million years, I can't imagine you doing that.
No, I came rough and raw. I was still fighting in car parks at 19, 20, 21 before I got to Palace. And then all of a sudden, I've gone from a builder to a professional footballer and get the ball for a throw on and that. And you're getting vitriol abuse there to here. And you know what I mean? You think to yourself, if I could only... You know what I mean? You think that's what I'm thinking. You know, whereas Cyril and all of them lot, it was literally a Martin Luther King, you know, turn the other cheek.
Okay, but you're not Martin Luther King then?
No, I'm Malcolm X. I was Malcolm X them times, but you know what I mean? I didn't want that to happen to me. I didn't want that.
Ian and Dion's generation marked the transition from black footballers being a shining, if beleaguered, minority to an era when they are merely the norm. In 1993, Kick It Out was started to try to tackle racism in football. That year, Paul Ince became the first black player to captain England. By the turn of the century, around 10% of professional footballers in England were black. And black culture became a big part of the game. A far cry from 1979 when the FA told Bob Hazel, "No, you can't have dreadlocks." Now, as the most marketable man on the planet showed, you could do what you like with your hair, whatever colour you were. So what about sort of culturally? I imagine the white players of that era listened to Elton John and Billy Joel and Neil Diamond and stuff like that. I mean, what were you listening to? Did you change anything?
It's going to the Wag, it's going to Crazy Larry's, Brown's. Listening to soul and funk.
But were you bringing the white boys with you?
They were following our lead. They'd be going, "Oh, what's this rubbish? What's this rubbish?" And then when you get in their car to go to training, they're playing that rubbish in their car.
A goal from a diving header.
So culturally, you brought new music into the dressing room. What about goal celebrations?
Well, to be honest, you know what? I think Shearer, Al, he copied one of my celebrations. I scored a goal and done this dance, the ball dance.
Oh,
really,
that's good.
You know, you've got to start. And I saw Al score a goal where he'd done something where it wasn't his normal five finger, right arm up, bent like this.
Yeah.
He'd done something like.
He tried to copy you.
When I saw it, I was laughing. It's only the other day I was asking. I'm sure Al, I saw you do a celebration. Did you do it?
No, I didn't.
Of course he'll remember it.
He's right.
Today, around 30% of professional footballers in Britain are black. Many of them are among the brightest stars in the game's galaxy. As for racist chanting, if it happens now, it tends to make national, even international news. So, problem solved. Or perhaps not. Jason Roberts is Cyril Regis's nephew. Racism sorted, job done. Not for Jason, not a bit of it.
So when you started playing, the days of monkey chanting were long gone. When did you first come across blatant racism?
One thing that really changed the way it worked was Twitter and online and the internet, because that was when you were able to receive abuse in a very direct way. You literally had to look at that. On social media, people are emboldened. They're in their room by themselves. They're not engaging with you. And it's much easier to show their true feelings. And their true feelings is, you know, they tweet me and say I'm a fucking nigger, or I'm this or I'm that, and my family are this.
What kind of thing? I mean, don't spare us. What kind of things have you seen?
I mean, black bastard, you know, fucking nigger, whatever it may be.
All
of that kind of stuff.
So we had the Twitter terrace then. The racist terrace was on Twitter now.
Absolutely. It kind of felt like the people's feelings, they knew they couldn't vent them on match day, so they find a way to be able to voice their displeasure at you or how they felt about your culture and your race on their phones or at their computers at home.
Did you think
media.
That had gone? Did you think that had disappeared from society until it came up on Twitter? Because I kind of thought it had. I can't believe still people are saying it.
I have to be honest, from the black players' perspective, it was somewhat of a unifying experience because all of us were going through this thing in front of each other. And I think it sort of told the truth that no matter what you are, whether you were a Premier League footballer, a bus driver or a janitor, the fact is you were just a black bastard at the end of the day. And this was the forum where we all shared that experience.
No one saying things aren't miles better. But neither can anyone pretend old school racism isn't alive and well on social media. And while every other player is black, what does it say about the game that such a tiny minority of black men are to be found in dugouts or boardrooms? Les Ferdinand is director of football at Queen's Park Rangers, one of the very few black men in such a role in this country.
To cut straight to the chase then, a third of the Premier League, for example, is black. Mm-hmm. And none of the managers are, and hardly any of the coaches in the Premier League that I can think of. You've been around in the only black bloke in directors' boxes all over the country.
Yeah, and quite in most of them, yeah. When I look now, I don't know how many black players have tried to get into roles of directors of football. I'm not sure there's too many, because perhaps they feel like management, like coaching, that door won't be open for them. And, you know, I was once asked by someone at the FA, is there a problem with black players believing that they won't get an opportunity to be managers and coaches? And I said, by the mere fact you're asking me that question, you know there's a problem. So I said, well, this is what we're trying to change. And that was in 1998.
Hardly anything's changed.
Exactly. And we're now in 2016.
So what's it going to take?
We won't be able to change boardrooms now. Don't matter how many programmes we do, we ain't going to be able to change boardrooms now. It's years down the line that this is going to happen. This is where the change is going to take place. We can do as many of these documentaries as you like. You ain't changing what's in people's heads right now.
Adrian walking along a street, then traffic passing West Bromwich Albion Stadium.
My journey back into the weirdly monochrome world of 1979's Whites versus Blacks match is nearly at an end.
Adrian stepping out onto the football pitch.
Ever since I was a little kid, empty football grounds, obviously especially this one, have absolutely transfixed me. It's like you can smell, you can feel the joys and horrors of all the years. But I just get slightly overwhelmed. It's particularly moving today because having become slightly obsessed with this testimonial we've been talking about, black versus white, we're having a bit of a reunion. We've tried to get hold of as many players who were here that day to come along, and some of the supporters too. I can't wait to see who turns up.
First to arrive are Cyril and Brendan.
Hello, morning, lovely men. How you doing?
All right. Bit of a scene here.
Nice to see you.
What do you feel when you're here?
Looking at the pitch, yeah, you can get itchy feet. I do anyway.
Then Tony Bomber Brown and Ali Robertson. Next, Vernon Hodgson.
It's the fourth degree.
Vernon, how are you, mate?
Nice to see you.
Ian Benjamin and Stuart Phillips.
Okay.
Yeah,
just this look. Here you are on here. Just see, you just you look so sort of meek.
Well, if you actually look closer to that,
yeah.
I'm looking down at Cyril and Laurie Cunningham thinking, what the hell am I doing?
Is that right?
It was just amazing to be there. Yeah.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Hervel Hector turns up to represent the black fans.
Oh, come around once in a lifetime.
And finally, Laurie Rampling, Albion's photographer.
They all make their way down a corridor lined with images of footballers.
And to thank them for turning up at this little reunion, I've a little something for them.
Yeah, I just want to... We've got something to show you on here, if you...
I've got hold of some news footage from the match that day, suspecting, rightly as it turns out, that none of them have seen it before.
Ready, everyone? Have a look at... Have a look at this.
The black players have been mustered from seven different English league clubs. 10 years ago, you'd have been lucky to find half a dozen throughout the country. But today, they feature in such unlikely sides as Hereford United. Albion's Len Cantello was celebrating 10 years with the club and had in his lineup old favourites like Johnny Giles. But as we were to discover, the collective skills of the All Blacks proved too much on the night. Cunningham opened the scoring, a neat shot from 20 yards.
Driven low.
There you go.
Cantello's 11 took the lead, but Garth Crooks levelled the score. It had been an entertaining night, and when it looked as if the game would end in a draw, Stuart Phillips of Hereford United made it 3-2. The innovation had proved attractive to the 7,000 who'd turned up and had given an insight into the deepening reservoir of black talent within the English game.
That is fantastic. I've never seen that footage.
Yeah.
It was just a feeling, speaking personally, I just had this feeling of this is special. It's unique.
Yeah. Cyril, have you seen that?
No, it's the first time. And to believe there's a bit of history like that is fantastic.
Have you seen that before, Vern?
No, I've never seen it before.
It must be strange.
Didn't know at the time that it was going to be somewhat like so important.
I just basically turned up with my boots. I think it's only now, just looking back on the occasion, that I realise the importance of it.
What I recollect, Adrian, actually, after all these years, that in the game, before the game in the dressing room, we were told to let them win.
The team photo.
So the black team got the victory they wanted.
Oh, you can hear the crease.
And Laurie gets another memorable picture for his archive.
That's beautiful.
That's sort of job done. Got them together. I'll tell you what I won't miss. Fascinating though this has been. I'm sick of talking about people in terms of whites and blacks. So I don't have to do that now for a while.
There are reasons to believe there will be a happy ending to the story of black footballers in Britain, even if we're further away from it than I thought. Football can often feel way behind the rest of society. On days like today, though, it feels like it may actually always have been a few steps ahead.